life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here as well.
Thank you for being here. So inshallah, we are going to continue talking about how to deal with inferiority complex, which was the topic of our previous program. And you generally told us what inferiority complex is, and now you are going to continue telling us some of the symptoms. One of those which you mentioned was about how a child will seem very cowardly, timid, extra shy, hates meeting children of his age.
Yeah. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. He sometimes also tries to act over smart. Because he wants to get that outside attention to fill in the gap of this inferiority complex. So he might ruin it, because that's not the way to act normally, right?
Yeah.
Over smart, overconfident. It spoils things for himself as well. And then he might also stammer while talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes he's scared and he wants his way, but he's wanting to get heard, so he might stammer. Sometimes it's a normal disorder, of course. So that has nothing to do with inferiority complex. But sometimes he might stammer due to this, you know, getting his way. Like, for example, especially near a teacher.
Yeah.
When he's really nagged at or shown negative behavior and always criticized and, you know, all these kinds of things. So he might stammer while talking, getting his way. He might not be confident enough to stand up and answer also for himself or defend himself. And he frequently gets irritated. Such a person frequently gets irritated and he seeks the attention. So, you know, when he doesn't get the proper psychological happiness at home, the emotional connection with his parents, because we're always nagging him, so he'll look at it elsewhere.
So he'll look for attention outside.
Yeah, and that's very bad, because as he grows up, you know, children get deviated.
Yeah.
They're on the right path. They think that at least my friends are giving me that satisfaction, psychological satisfaction, emotional satisfaction. They might fall in the wrong path also.
So do you think that this inferiority complex in reality is present even in a small content in everybody?
Definitely. Okay. Because parents sometimes keep a behavior that they don't want to forego that behavior.
Yeah.
Like if they start comparing a child, they'll always compare. Even taking examples, they should be very careful, you know. Some parents say, we take examples.
Yeah.
That's not like example as in somebody you see always.
You
can take
right.
other examples of maybe long time ago people or some people that the child doesn't know of, you know, so that the child can feel that he's not part of my life. But when he's part and parcel of the child's life, he feels he's being compared to.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So all these kind of things creep a kind of an inferiority complex to a certain level, even at a small level. But we can, inshallah, get rid of that. Parents
inshallah.
Are smart enough, if they're real perfectionists,
yeah.
they can get rid of that instead of, you know, just keeping on with these kind of attitudes. Now, well, let's go to the steps to prevent this inferiority complex.
Okay.
So that's when the role of the parents, especially the mother, comes. Mind you, when I say mother, I don't mean the father is excluded. The father is part and parcel of the family, and his relationship with the children counts as much as the mother's relationship towards the child. And these two build a strong foundation for the child to carry on.
Definitely.
You know, without this complex. Because sometimes I've heard of a child, an innocent girl who's now grown up, but her father was always telling her things, you know, that why do you look in the mirror? For example, a child, a girl, when she's growing up, she likes looking in the mirror. You think you can be like that actress whom you're watching on TV? And she used to feel very bad about it.
Yeah.
So this also makes the complex of the child be built that she feels that she's not pretty enough, you know, she's ugly or something like that, which is not a good feeling at all.
That's so unfortunate. All right, we're just going to take a short break and we will be back for more on this, inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and the show is Islamic Upbringing with our sister, Sister Salma Khalfan. We have been talking about how to get rid of this inferiority complex, and you are telling us on ways to prevent this inferiority complex.
So first of all, the parent can make the child know of his or her unique gift that Allah has given them.
Yeah.
Okay. However, maybe the child is not very clever or very creative, or some things missing in the child that the parents would like that, you know, that trait to be there in the child. But the parents always look for that and they compare and they spoil the image,
you know,
of their own image as well as the child's inner, you know, state. They spoil it in the long run. That's why inferiority complex creeps in.
Why they feel they're not good enough.
Yeah. So the child should be made aware of his unique qualities.
Okay.
So the parents can talk to them, for example, that if they have, and Allah gives everyone a unique quality. And even if the people who are really like, you know, handicapped or they can't perform enough like normal people, they even have a unique, you know, gift Allah has bestowed.
Definitely.
Upon everyone. That's Allah's doing. Of course, He's gifted everyone with a certain quality, and that's the parents' work to find out. And parents are smart enough to find out that my child has this and this.
Has this strength.
Yeah, exactly. So always to instill that you remember you can give your share in the world with this quality, and always remind them, and always, you know, like focus on that to be more and more, you know, stronger in that the child. Like, for example, if he knows how to build the blocks well, so, you know, you have to praise that and say that one day you will, inshallah, be a builder. You know, you'll build good buildings or something like that. Or if he's good in writing, that one day you'll write, you know, a book.
Yeah, I think this kind of inspirations, especially given by parents, is very important, because in the end, the child is looking up at the parents, and if they show them that they are able to do something, then they will definitely try.
Yeah, they will definitely try. Yeah. If they show, you know, that appreciation to the child will feel that, yes, I have something to look forward to, yeah?
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, some children may have so many capabilities, but they're not very good in social interaction. So the child, the mother keeps on, or the father keeps on saying, you didn't behave nicely with these people. Yeah. You are good for nothing. You know, you always make us feel ashamed. So the child will have so many abilities, but because of that, he'll always feel secluded, and he'll feel that inferiority complex.
Yeah.
And all those signs will come in him, you know.
And also this fact about, you know, not having some gift, like some traits and some positives. For example, even if I'm good at something, I'm not good at something else, Allah wants us to build on that thing that we are not good in.
That's so right. Generally,
as parents, they should focus on their good qualities, those which are, you know, eminent.
Yeah.
And then these other qualities, they should slowly help them gently.
Exactly.
So that later on when they grow up, the child knows that, okay, now for those things that I'm not able to do, I'm supposed
balance
to try
it,
and, you know, and try and reach that. I can even reach the same level.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I like that too much, what you said. And inculcate that to the child, that it's not the end of the world.
Exactly.
You can still practice these kind of qualities to come in you, you know, and encourage the child so the child cannot feel neglected.
Exactly. Thank you very much. So we're just going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Inshallah, stay tuned.
Ya Muqiyal Khayrat, Ya Muqiyal Khayrat.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Ya Muqiyal Khayrat, Ya Muqiyal Khayrat.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about the steps to prevent this inferiority complex that is formed in a child, and one of very important things that I feel you mentioned was making them feel that they are unique and outlining their strengths.
Yeah, that's right. Now, another point to deal with this inferiority complex when it's come, especially, or you just don't want it to even enter in the first place, always show these kind of characters, always keep this attitude with your child. You know, all these things are very positive with a child. So whether the inferiority complex be there or not, but of course, with being there, these really specially help this kind of attitude towards the child. So another one is acceptance.
Okay.
You have to accept your child as the child is. For example, if the child is just not performing well in school, you can't force it. Maybe his IQ is low,
yeah,
but it doesn't mean that, you know, now things are static. You can't, nothing can be done with about it. You have to accept the fact that this child is a bit slow, right? So try to be enthusiastic about it with him.
Exactly.
Don't make him feel disappointed. Try to tell him the main thing is struggling, you know. Allah rewards for struggling. People reward for the marks maybe in the school, but Allah rewards for your struggle. How? And I am the one who is happy with you. And if Allah is happy with you, what more could you want? Slowly, slowly building that positive feeling in a child would really take him, you know, a great deal forward, I guess. So accepting the child and not having high expectations, which is one of the major causes of inferiority complex in the child. You know, everyone wants the child to be like a superstar, but
they want them to excel in every field,
exactly,
everything.
Every field. So parents should realize this and accept the child as they are, instead of pushing them to acquire external traits. Parents should help the kids now discover the intrinsic qualities, you know, the qualities that matter, the virtues that matter. Like, there's so many things that will be accorded for in the hereafter, and in dunya also they play a great deal, like good akhlaq, you know, behaving good with the people, politeness, doing good to people, having a charitable hand. All these things are the main values that take you forward. Having a degree and good marks is not something that paves the way to success. Success in both worlds are what Islam tells us as these kind of values. So intrinsic qualities should be laid emphasis on.
Definitely.
High expectations and unnecessary burden to excel in everything can make a child afraid of failures, you know, which could eventually lead to a feeling of being inferior. So,
and
you know, when you have high expectations towards a child, then the child will always fear of doing, you know, badly, being a failure. Even in games, they say that when we are playing with children, we should keep a neutral attitude when they win or lose, so that do not make them feel that they've done a bad thing. Don't make them feel a sore loser. Let him take it graciously. It's just a game.
Exactly.
And after all, life is just a game.
And I guess also if the parents themselves, when they lose in something and then they overreact, you know, the child is seeing. So I guess even the way the parents, or not even the parents, just even the siblings or anything, just this outward reaction to something really plays an impact. And
So they don't take that intrinsic quality very important as the outside qualities. So like, for example, win and lose situation. Always make them feel that it's just a game. Or if for example, they didn't try enough, maybe you can tell them, like, as far as performance in school is concerned, you can talk to them what was the, you know, cause. And I'm sure the benefits would overweigh them.
Definitely, definitely, inshallah.
Of talking to them, that is.
Definitely. Inshallah, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Inshallah, till the next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
آیه دیگه هم در اینجا عرض میکنیم و اون آیه مبارکه اینه که فرماید اعوذ بالله من الشیطان.
In آیه 152 of سوره البقره we read, remember me and I will remember you, and thank me and do not be ungrateful to me. In this verse of the Holy Quran, remembrance of Allah means that we in every aspect of our lives pay attention to Allah and His signs in our lives. It also means to be attentive to things which help us to remember Allah, such as the Holy Quran and the infallible Imams. In better words, everything which can be considered a means to connect us to Allah must be taken care of. The answer to our remembrance of Allah is He remembering us, and this is great reward for Muslims. Now, how Allah will remember His servants. Some scholars believe that Allah will send His special blessings upon the servants who remember him frequently. Thus, know that whenever someone remembers Allah in every action in life, in answer, Allah will remember that person too. And Allah is grateful to those who are thankful towards Him. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khalav Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Economic divide.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to Economic Divide with Mika Batahwaii. To start off the year, we're going to be taking a look at the Saudi Arabian budget deficit, a deficit that has a sum of around $79 billion, something that will no doubt pinch the pockets of the world's largest oil producer. Now, for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the reliance on oil is something that is reflected heavily in its GDP. Yet, as we can see from this chart over here, the impact of the coronavirus on oil prices around the world was the second largest fall in history, when in March 2020, prices fell by 31.5%. So, how did the oil crash affect the Saudi GDP? Again, let's refer to this next graph that you see over here. We can see that until Q3 of 2019, that's the bar that you see here on Q3, GDP had a positive growth rate, yet with the arrival of the COVID-19 virus and a global fall in the demand for oil, the Saudi GDP slipped with Q2, seeing a 7.5% drop. That is reflected over here for Q2, and then moving on to Q3, that dropped to around 4%, as you see in this chart. Now, with uncertainty still surrounding a recovery, no wonder things are looking down for the Saudis. Let's now take a look at our first report and look at the global oil crash in more detail and see just how Saudi Arabia has been hit the hardest.
Things were looking very rosy for the bank account of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia over the last decade. With 266 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, the boom times certainly allowed the dollars to flow into the nation, allowing the despotic Saudi royal family to rule a reign of lavish luxury, whilst letting ordinary citizens slip into poverty. But in 2020, the world woke up to the impact of the COVID-19 crisis, a world pandemic that would affect the health and lives of millions and bring economies to their knees, and things were no different for the Saudis. Whereas the KSA has not been immune to the virus in terms of human costs. In fact, with 363,000 cases recorded and over 6,200 deaths, it's the impact on the economy that's truly hit home with Riyadh, with the GDP falling some 7.5% since the start of 2020. The reason for this has been the sharp drop in the price of oil. As the virus has clearly demonstrated over the last 12 months, the demand for fuel has slipped, falling from $71.34 a barrel in 2018 to a year low of just $9.12 per barrel in 2020, something that the Saudis were not expecting, it seems, as the national budget deficit is now a staggering $79 billion. To add insult to the injury, an economic war was triggered in March 2020 between the Saudi regime and Russia, with oil prices at the heart of the battle. The price sparked a quarterly fall of 65% in oil prices, with crude and Brent falling around 25%. The resulting oil war, as well as the effect of the COVID-19 virus, sparked a global stock market crash, costing trillions. With the world still yet to recover from the various impacting factors in 2020, things are not looking too bright for Saudi Arabia, with oil prices still low and a budget deficit that has hurt its economy.
Joining me in the studio today is Atife Padida. Atife, welcome and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us here today. Okay, now before we get into details about the Saudi oil crisis, we spoke to Hossein Askari. He's a professor of international business at the George Washington University, and he's also a former board member on the IMF, and he was an advisor to the Saudi Ministry of Finance. Well, let's listen to what he said about how the crash has affected the Saudi economy and how the average Saudi is faring now compared to the so-called boom years.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's very nice to be with you. Let me just back up and say that when you look at the Saudi economy, it is very heavily oil dependent. Roughly 80% of Saudi Arabia's exports are oil, and about another 10% are oil related, namely plastics and petrochemicals. So when oil prices go down, Saudi Arabia is in trouble. And then the second issue is that the revenues of the country, government revenues, is about 75% comes from oil. And so when oil prices again go down, government revenues go down. And Saudi Arabia at the same time has some fixed expenditures that it tries to make. And those, I can list those, but basically, you know, the important ones are domestic subsidies, military expenditures, also money for the large ruling family of Saudi Arabia, which is probably around 17,000 people. All of these things cost money, and so they have to spend that. So the country basically then runs into deficits, and Saudi Arabia has budget deficits of roughly 10-12% recently. So this is not sustainable, and so when this happens, the simple guy on the road, on the streets, get actually squeezed. And so what you have to do, they can't squeeze them too much because then you have domestic problems, and so they run deficits. That's where it's at.
Okay, very well. Atife, with Saudi Arabia so heavily dependent on oil, as we know, how do you think that the price drop has impacted the economy there and in total or overall the Saudi regime? And also, do you think that the Saudi economy is going to be suffering as a result of this, and for what length of time? Some have said could be a few years.
Well, definitely, Saudi oil income contributes to two-thirds of its public revenue. So less oil money means financial trouble in public sectors, which directly affects the people of Saudi Arabia. Now, the government might start introducing measures like rising taxes. They have started with VAT and introducing some austerity measures, which will not be welcomed by people of Saudi Arabia. They're not accustomed to this sort of situation. At the moment, a lot of people in Saudi Arabia are critical of the government because of the rising unemployment, which will continue due to these financial difficulties. And a lot of them are saying that this situation could be prevented if the government would spend less on military and stop the war in Yemen, which brought them nothing but international condemnation, and focus that money on the people. This situation wouldn't be happening.
Okay, very well. Thanks for that. Well, let's take a look now at how Saudi Arabia is trying to move away from their reliance on oil as bin Salman, the crown prince, tries to modernize the country, albeit to some quite rightly skeptical views from foreign nations of Saudi human rights records.
Bin Salman, the crown prince of the Saudi regime, ousted his nearest rivals in a bloodless coup that essentially made him the de facto ruler of the kingdom, going as far as imprisoning some of his relatives and even killing people who spoke out against him, none more so infamous than the brutal fashion in which a journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, met his fate at the hands of bin Salman's murder hit squad. Part of the regime that bin Salman wished to implement under his rule was the so-called 2030 vision, a plan that would see the kingdom introduce a strategic framework designed to reduce the nation's dependence on oil and concentrate on other sources of income. Many question whether this will be a success, with certain examples already proving to be a failure, with various sporting personalities refusing to attend high-profile events in the country. However, some have agreed, and some academics feel that the move away from oil onto more diverse projects has potential to succeed.
I think that the new approach, which is reflected in the broader 2030 vision, if implemented as outlined, it will take off. Now, that is contingent on the government and the leaders implementing, creating the enabling environment, which is very key for it to take off. This will include, of course, some of the things that are already outlined in the vision, in particular, a continuation with the development of infrastructure.
But for Bin Salman and his grand idea, there still lies several fundamental flaws in his approach. Firstly, as we've discussed, is the shocking history of human rights in the country, as seen in the murder of Khashoggi, but also the inequality between men and women, the notion of modern slavery in the kingdom, the terrible ongoing destruction of Yemen, and of course, the infighting between Saudi royals themselves, all lead many to question as to just how far this project can go before it collapses. The idea, however, is something that other nations in the Persian Gulf region have also considered adopting, with the likes of the United Arab Emirates, for example, branching out into fields of tourism and technology, and the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, which is also thriving outside of its gas income, with the FIFA World Cup heading to Qatar next year, and of course the highly successful aviation industry, spearheaded by award-winning Qatar Airways, notably the only operator to thrive during the COVID-19 pandemic.
If you look at the Gulf countries, they both seem to have taken quite a similar path. They all seem to have developed a broader economic and political and social kind of framework, which they are implementing. I think the difference is that the pace of development is quite maybe slightly different, or the pace of the implementation is quite slightly different.
Joining us back in the studio is Hossein Askari. Professor, Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states have taken huge steps to move away from economic reliance on oil, coming up with a range of alternative economic plans. Do you think that this tactic will work, or will setup costs prove too costly?
Well, I think that eventually, of course, oil runs out. And so any country has got to do something to make sure that this oil lasts in some fashion. Now, I am a firm believer in Islamic economics and what the Quran teaches about finance and economics. And it's very, very clear, no one with any brain can dispute this, that in Islam, what is under the ground, namely depletable resources, belong equally to all members of the present and future generations. But let me just say this, to be able to transform your economy from oil to something else, you need more than just a vision. You need more than just somebody saying, we're going to do this. You need to create a setup in a country where there is the rule of law and where there are incentives for the private sector to develop those things. Saudi Arabia has not done that. And so when you try to, as a government, to try to set the direction for how you're going to go from an oil economy to a non-oil economy, it's very difficult for the government to say, well, we're going to pick this particular sector, that particular sector, and invariably it doesn't work. And until you have a setup, an environment, the condition for the private sector to flourish, and Saudi Arabia does not have that. So I think it'll be a very costly mistake in the long run, because it has not done the spade work in order to set up for a resurgence of the private sector.
Okay, not too optimistic for Saudi Arabia. Atifa bin Salman has stated that he wants to diversify the Saudi economy, said that many times. And, of course, he's talked about this 2030 vision that Professor there also talked about, the aim to boost tourism, infrastructure, leisure, recreation, things of that nature. But there have already been several boycotts of Mohammed bin Salman really in particular, and Saudi Arabia as a whole, by the idea about these big brand names who and stars who want to actually make advancements, but they're concerned about the like the human rights record of Saudi Arabia. Do you think that this plan, this vision is going to work? Or do you think that Saudi Arabia actually has too many skeletons in its closet?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman established his authority through massive crackdowns on the dissent, locking up competitors in luxury hotels, ordering the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, waging a war in Yemen, and being involved in a blockade on Qatar. Now, these sort of behaviors discourage many investors, and a lot of investors in the future are thinking, is this a man that we want to work, a pro-violence, anti-democracy guy? They're looking for safe places to invest, especially with the ongoing pandemic and the financial crisis across the globe. So I don't think that the investors are going to be encouraged to invest in this vision. And at the same time, Bin Salman was heavily reliant on the income from oil to make this dream happen. And with the drop in the oil revenues and the ongoing pandemic, I think his dream is dying away.
Okay, very well. Well, we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up, including more from Atife and a new section of our show. It's called A Thousand Words. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahwai. Time now to take a look at a change of policy in Arab-Persian Gulf states in our in-depth section. Now, as we have seen in recent months, several nations have normalized ties with the Israel regime, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Many suggest that the Saudi regime may also follow the trend, but Riyadh appears to be stalling for now. Well, according to a report by Karen Uziel of Focus Economics, which was cited in this entry, she has stated that the biggest winner of the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime will be the poorest nation, that being Sudan. Yet between Israel, the UAE, and the U.S., a $3 billion fund promoting economic developments will be launched, which may also tempt the Saudis. Now, she also has stated that for Saudi Arabia to fully and officially normalize ties with Israel will mean a change of power at the top, believing that Bin Salman will have to replace his father for that to happen, which may spark huge protests and then in the process let down the people of Palestine. Well, the Israeli regime has offered to sweeten the deal with the Saudis by offering them an incentive, namely providing the so-called Iron Dome missile system once ties are normalized, something that the Saudi regime will no doubt at due time, due to its love of weapons, may jump at this. But for now, it has rejected it. Well, Israel itself is desperate for business. For example, check out this entry over here, an Israeli-Saudi Silicon Wadi to benefit both. Now, this is for the tech sector. An Israeli-Saudi union here will obviously benefit both, but Israel is looking to expand itself because of the fact that COVID-19 has affected countries around the world, and one of the main sources of income for the Saudis was the U.S. Cybersecurity, for example, is one of the fields, not to mention agritech, fintech, and digital health.
They say the difference between a man and a boy is the price of his toys. And this is no different for Bin Salman, who since taking pseudo charge of the country has spent billions on military hardware, ranging from the latest fighter jets to the most devastating bombs, most of which come from Western suppliers, and in particular, the United States of America. But the military deals taking place are riddled with corruption, hence proving why so much spending has left the kingdom with such a huge deficit, all caused by the bad deals that allow certain individuals to profit in the process.
There have been, in fact, some military contracts in which the commission was larger than the actual contract, maybe over 100%. There have been military contracts in which later on what are called the add-ons were larger than the initial contract, which also tells you that there was corruption going on, so they had to basically later on come and add money to it to make up for it. Namely, the contractor was told what was the highest other bid so that, or the lowest other bid, I'm sorry, so they could go below that. So there are all of these things why the military contracts occur.
However, for the cameras, the corruption is not an issue, as the likes of Trump and Bin Salman laugh and joke about billion-dollar contracts, which Trump labelled as peanuts to the Saudi regime. The final destination of the weapons and bombs bought from the US and the UK is no laughing matter. Bin Salman's also been the mastermind and chief instigator of the ongoing war in Yemen, where the very deals signed by the Saudis to buy US weapons have seen over 233,000 people killed in the country at the hands of Saudi attacks and sanctions. With the war looking like an unwinnable mission for Riyadh, it seems that the excessive spending on military hardware, some of which has never been used, either through lack of knowledge as to how to use it, or simply not having had the opportunity to do so, has meant that the overall budget on the war has brought few tangible gains for the Saudi military. With estimates placing the Saudi spending on the war in Yemen being at around $200 million per day, it's no wonder then that the Saudi budget has run down.
We're joined back in the studio with Atafeh, but before we head into our discussion, let's hear one more time from Professor Hossein Askari. We asked him a question about the Saudi military program.
The military expenditures, it's done for a variety of reasons. Let's just be very frank about it. Saudi Arabia cannot really defend itself, but it does not have anyone who wants to invade it. And if anyone does invade it, Saudi Arabia will get the backing of the United States military, and now I believe of Israel's. So why do they spend all this money on military? Well, I think it's number one is to reward the U.S. military complex, because the United States wants to export military hardware that reduces the cost of every unit that the U.S. military then buys. There's a second reason, and that is corruption. Is that in fact the commissions that are paid in military contracts are enormous. They run into the billions. So it's a way to channel money to various people inside and outside Saudi Arabia. I believe that much of that equipment is not against foreigners, but is to be used eventually if there is a domestic disturbance. And so it is prepositioned for Americans to come and help the Saudi family out.
He's a great guest for this program. Okay, Atafeh, we have seen Donald Trump accepting billions of dollars from the Saudi regime, obviously in return for what the professor said there, for military weapons. This week actually saw another $290 million of arms being sold to Saudi Arabia, well, approved to be sold to Saudi Arabia. And this is a last push by Trump to arm, obviously, his friend, especially Mohammed bin Salman. Now, do you think that the incoming President Joe Biden, if he does actually get confirmed, is he going to be following Trump's footsteps, do you think?
Well, Saudi Arabia has been the United States' greatest ally in this region. I don't think that alignment is going to change with Biden coming to the office. But I think Biden is a man who cares about his international image, so he would be more careful the way he treats Saudi Arabia. But in terms of economic trades, I think there are going to be more trade deals between these two countries, especially now that the United States is in financial trouble itself. But in other things, I think regarding the human rights issues, Biden would be more careful to address these issues, things that, for example, Bin Salman does, you know, the things that he does. I think that's the only thing that would change. That's it.
Very well. Thank you very much for your input. We appreciate it. Atafeh Payidar, researcher and journalist. Sure. The Saudi regime is run by a family that appears to be living a lavish lifestyle, fueled by oil sales that provide easy income to spend on luxury goods, sophisticated military weapons, and most worryingly of all, buying the silence of the Western international community following the brutal assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But it seems that the impact of the coronavirus and the slump in oil prices have left the bank vaults of the Saudi regime with bare shelves, raising the question as to whether the kingdom is being mismanaged by a young, inexperienced, and power-hungry crown prince who has yet to understand the value of money. What now remains to be seen is whether oil prices will increase in the near future, and if so, what lies ahead for the Saudi regime, with outgoing President Trump causing Riyadh to lose yet another ally, and hence the possible reason why it is now extending the hand of friendship to Tel Aviv, something that many will no doubt condemn as an act of treason. That's just about all the time we have for this episode. I'd like to thank both Professor Hossein Askari and Professor Collins Nithman for being on the show. And on behalf of myself, Atifa, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and our program For Humanity, where we are discussing Risalatul Huquq, the Treaties of Rights of Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him. And in this particular haqq, which is haqq number 37, haqqul khaliq, the rights of the associate or those who you associate with, Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, tries to highlight certain things that we need to be very, very observant of. And that is the first thing that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْخَلِيطَ فَأَنْ لَا تَغُرَّهُ وَلَا تَغُشَّهُ. And as for the rights of your associate, that you do not trick them and that you do not deceive them. Continuing on with what we were speaking about in the previous session, giving an outlook on how necessary it is for us to be very, very selective when it comes to our associates. You know, there's a few traditions that speak about, you know, if you are so observant of what comes into your stomach, why are you not observant of, or equally observant, or more observant of the knowledge and who gives you the knowledge? Why are you not observant of the type of people and the quality of people that mix around you? We even have cases in the history of our imams, peace be upon them, where people have asked, why did Imam, for example, Imam Sadiq's elder son, you know, deviate away from the path and whatnot? And the answer to this is because of their associates. And again, this is not something only related to this religion or that religion. It's something that all of us as a collective society around the world needs to be cautious of, for ourselves and also for our children. It isn't just entertainment, but more of being responsible for who it is that you're mixing with. You know, you want to have fun. You are entitled to have some entertainment and some time off. You need to socialize, but be responsible, be cautious of who these individuals or who this individual is. You don't want to mix with someone who is dubious, or else no one will be blamed except for yourself. Sometimes you find someone who, in principle, does not have and does not share the same values as you. What are you going to benefit from them? How are you going to be able to influence them in a positive way? Or what do you see yourself to be influenced by them in the positive way, especially when you are going to be in their presence and you will absorb that kind of atmosphere and environment? And in most cases, if not in all cases, they will weaken the foundation that you have. Just going to go for a short break and we will be back soon.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Just before the break, we were speaking about you and I and everyone around us needing to be more careful about who we socialize with. And if you're not careful, then this person who might not have the same values as you might weaken the foundation that you have, might trigger in your mind dangerous misconceptions that are completely baseless as well. But yet, because of your vulnerability, because maybe of your emotional attachment to that person, you know, this is what happens. And therefore, your morals and your views and your behavior and your conduct will all be changing. And we're not only talking about your ideological views, we're also talking about your conduct and your behavior. There might be cases where, you know, you get to know somebody and they might, you know, want to introduce you to bad things. You know, well, it's only one puff, it's only a smoke, it's only us damaging public property, it's only, you know, mixing with this kind of person. Yes, he only has a small criminal record, and then one thing drags onto another thing, and then another thing, and unfortunately, this goes down the wrong way. And this reminds me of a nice piece of poetry that has been said in Arabic, الريح آخذ مما تمر به, that wind takes up whatever it goes over. نتنا من النتن أو طيب من الطيب, whether it be a stinky smell, the wind absorbs that stinky smell, or whether it be a pleasant scent, that wind absorbs the pleasant scents. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he has said, مثل الجليس الصالح مثل العطار, the likes of a good company, because you can say khaliyat, you can say Nadim, you can say Jalis, all of them have in Arabic have the same meaning, and that is your those who you are in company with, those who are your accomplices, those who are your associates, those who are your friends, those who you mix with. Mathalul Jalis Salih, Mathalul Attar, is like a perfume seller, a perfume merchant. إن لم يصبك من عطره أصبت من ريحه. If you are not fortunate to get any perfume from him, you will absorb the scent that comes from this عطار, this perfume merchant. ومثل الجليس السوء, and as for an evil, a bad associates, مثل القيران إن لم يحترق ثوبك أصابك من ريحه. It's like the likes of tar, that if that tar doesn't burn your clothing, you are going to be inflicted by its scent and its bad odor. A lot more needs to be said about this. We will continue on in speaking about Imam As-Sajjad's segment here on Haqqul Khaliq in our next program, The Right of an Associate. And until then, please visit us on parstoday.com, or alternatively, you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. And until then, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aqil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zaid al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. This chapter speaks about how we are able to protect and preserve our body and keep it away from any harm, and the hurma, the prohibition of bringing about any kind of harm to our body. You know, we don't really appreciate our saha and our health until we, unfortunately, might lose it. And that's why a healthy body is very important. A healthy mind is very important. So we need to understand what are the factors, what are the elements that bring about a healthy body, a healthy mind, a healthy intellect. And, you know, all of these are hadith that speak about the hifz, the protection of your nafs, the health hifz of your soul, your spirit, your mind, your body. And most importantly, that all of this should be taken into consideration, because our body is an amana given to us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You can't allow yourself to be placed in a predicament where you know there will be harm inflicted onto you. You can't inflict harm onto yourself as well. You know, إيذاءُ النفس itself is haram. You also cannot throw yourself, as the verse in the Holy Quran says, you cannot throw yourself into a perishable kind of state where you know that you will, you know, there will be harm inflicted onto you. Of course, you know, we need to look at that in particular situation as it is, you know, and not look beyond more than what needs to be interpreted. But when you